So I'm going to be teaching a lesson tonight that you can see on the screen, and you should be receiving an outline. Now, there are going to be a number of quotes in this lesson, like I use in most of my presentations, and you will be able to go online and download those if you want. Always know that you can go to fairviewbaptistedmond.org and get all of the lessons and messages that we teach. But you also are going to be receiving a handout where you can write some of these things down. Feel free, if you want to take a picture of one of the quotes, to just pull out your cell phone and do that. But just know that all of this will be in a few days on our website, on our church website. So you'll be able to download it if you want it. But obviously, if you want something to use on your phone as a meme or to send to someone else, you're more than welcome to do that. Okay, so feel the freedom to do so. This is one of the sessions that I teach at our Liberty Pastors training camps that we teach to our pastors. One of our goals, especially on day one, is to try to dispel a lot of the myths that pastors have been taught and then, of course, incorrectly believe, and it's translated into their own ministries, so it keeps them from speaking out on critical subjects. They don't understand things like separation of church and state. They don't understand Romans 13, or at least from my perspective, they don't. And so they believe that Paul says you have to submit no matter what. Well, is that what he said? I don't believe it is. And so I wrote a book on that a little over a year ago. And I also deal with this topic. This is one of the topics that I teach. So first of all, I think it's really good that all of you from time to time are exposed to what we teach our pastors so you can have a good idea that when we say, hey, we're going to be in, you know, at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, we're going to be teaching the pastors, you're going to have a good idea of some of the things that they're going to be hearing, at least on day one. So normally what happens is that night, Paul teaches on the compartmentalization of Christianity, how modern Christians are schizophrenic. We have our spiritual lives and we have our secular lives and we don't mix the two. And then I do the black robe presentation, and that kind of gets the juices flowing for everybody. And then the next day, which typically is either a Tuesday morning if we start on a Monday night, or a Monday morning if we start on a Sunday night, we start our class time, and I teach three sessions, and this is one of them. So I thought that you would enjoy it, not only because this is what we teach the pastors at our camps, but this is vital information for any Christian who is wondering about the church and the IRS and the Johnson Amendment. So I thought you would enjoy this lesson. So we're gonna have at it. At the very end of the lesson, you'll watch about a seven and a half minute video from Matt Staver that we actually play to our pastors. Now, sometimes his videos are a little longer than that, but you're gonna see the section on this very topic. And so he comes in and adds the muscle to what I have to say so that they know that, hey, this is not just Dan and Paul who are trying to get us arrested, but there's actually some legal minds that agree. And so you're going to be seeing that at the end of the lesson. For some reason, yeah, there we go, Dan. For some reason, we lost everything there for just a second. All right, so let's pray and get started, okay? Father, in Jesus' name, I pray that you would teach us these marvelous truths. Teach us by the power of your Holy Spirit. God, I pray it in Jesus' name. We pray for Paul and Cindy in Idaho as they are there right now. Bless them and their efforts. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we're going to be talking about the dreaded IRS. We're going to be talking about the Johnson Amendment. How does the church interface with all of these things? Some of you may have seen this quote before, but this is a painting of William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army. Most of us, when we hear Salvation Army, we think of red pots and people ringing bells outside of Walmart in December, right? Well, that's certainly a little bit of what the Salvation Army does and is, but that's a far cry from what the Salvation Army is and what it was originally organized to do. Brother, if you could you close that door for me? Could you close that door for me? Thank you so very, very much. The Salvation Army actually was formed in the 1800s as an incredibly powerful evangelistic association. And William Booth was known as a powerful preacher and an evangelist. So he's more than just someone who collected money to buy kids toys at Christmas. I want you to listen to what he said. He said, the chief danger of the 20th century will be religion without the Holy Ghost, Christianity without Christ, forgiveness without repentance, salvation without regeneration, politics without God, and heaven without hell. Now, he said that in the 1800s. Has his prophecy come to pass in America? Sadly, it has. So this is one of the reasons why I believe the church is so ineffective. We have fallen for some of these things, and there's much there that we could talk about, but obviously the politics without God is a section that we really hammer with these pastors, because for so many pastors, they just don't understand how to integrate their faith into the political arena, even though the political arena where our laws are made is a critical area for people. There are two areas that touch our lives probably as much as anything in our lives, and that's our faith, or what some people would call religion, and politics. And those are the two things that most people say, well, around here we just don't talk about religion and politics. Well, you just took two of the most important things off the table. Now, we understand that there's a lot of political wrangling. Well, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about politics. We're not talking about who's going to be the next Speaker of the House or who's going to be the Republican chair. What we're talking about is the art and science of governance. That's what we mean by politics. And we don't think our faith should be infused into that, and we shouldn't talk about those subjects. Oh, my gosh. That's quite the contrary. So let's begin with this first initial thought. Scripture teaches that we should pay our taxes. And I don't want you to get the idea that Paul and I believe that we ought to be evading taxation. I do believe you should take every possible advantage to reduce the amount of taxes that you pay to the federal and state governments. But we do believe that we should pay our taxes. In fact, Romans 13, verses 6 and 7 tell us that we need to pay our taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs. We should recognize the authorities. If you think about it, Jesus' birth in Bethlehem was caused by taxation. Have you ever thought about that? Jesus was born in Bethlehem as a fulfillment of prophecy, but the actual circumstances that brought him there to be born was taxation. And you'll find that in Luke chapter 2, verse 1. Jesus fellowshipped with tax collectors. Tax men were a part of Jesus' life. If you look at Matthew 9:11, the Pharisees were really upset because he said to Jesus, or they said to Jesus' disciples, your teacher eats with tax collectors and sinners. Notice tax collector. It's kind of interesting that they connected tax collectors to sinners. Nothing has changed, right? Everything is still the same. Tax collectors, sinners, pretty much the same these days. Jesus chose a tax collector as one of his disciples. What was his name? Yeah, Levi or Matthew. And so in Mark chapter 2, verse 14, this is the calling of Levi, or who we sometimes more commonly know as Matthew, and he was a tax collector. So Jesus was very familiar with taxes and taxation. In fact, Matthew chapter 17, verses 24 through 27, Jesus was intentional about paying his taxes. Now, this doesn't mean that he believed all the taxes were fair. In fact, he tells his disciples, we don't want to be offensive to the powers that be, so we need to pay our taxes. So Jesus paid his taxes. Jesus taught others to pay their taxes. You remember when they brought the coin to Jesus? Excuse me, not the coin. They're going to show him a coin, but they brought the question to Jesus, should we pay our taxes? Of course, they're trying to trip him up. They're wanting him to say, no, Caesar's not God. And then, of course, they could prosecute him for sedition and other things. You remember this is when he asked for the coin and he says, well, whose inscription is this? And they said, Caesar's. And he said, well, then you render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God, not or, and to God. It's not an either or. You can do both. We can chew or gum and walk at the same time. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. So notice there, once again, he's telling others, pay your taxes. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's. Now, with that understood, we need to understand the church and its tax immune or tax exempt status. Most people do not understand why the church is not taxed. Most people believe that it's because our government is so nice, it just decided to be really nice and not tax the church. Well, it has nothing to do with the church being nice or benevolent. So the church's tax-exempt status is not a gift bestowed by a benevolent government. That's the first thing you need to know. It's not a gift. You say, well, what is it? Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. This is Eric Stanley. Eric Stanley used to be one of the lead attorneys for Alliance Defending Freedom. In fact, he was the attorney that led the Pulpit Freedom Initiative, where we challenged the Johnson Amendment. For those of you who remember that, Paul and I got to know Eric very well. And in talking about why the church is not taxed, I want you to listen to a few things that he had to say. With all of the discussion swirling about whether church leaders can speak freely about electoral candidates from the pulpit, one question frequently comes to the fore. If a church wants to talk about the positions of electoral candidates, it can just give up the gift of tax-exempt status bestowed by the government. He says that would be simple enough if it wasn't so completely wrong. That's because churches receive a tax exemption as a matter of constitutional right, not legislative grace. Now, boy, if you didn't hear anything else in that quote, you need to get that last line. Churches receive a tax exemption as a matter of constitutional right, not legislative grace. You need to learn that. Most Christians do not know that. And so they don't want to rile up the government because they say, boy, if we stir up the government, they'll come and take this right or this gift away. Well, it's not a gift. It's a right. And the government has no authority under our Constitution to take away rights. The third point, the framers saw the church as a sovereign entity and therefore tax exempt from the federal government and then state governments as well. So what do you mean, Dan, by sovereign entity? Well, the framers understood that there are entities that are independent of other entities, and therefore one of these independent entities does not have the authority to tax another independent entity. Now, let me illustrate that. The founders believed that a sovereign entity, such as the federal government, had no authority to tax another sovereign entity, such as an individual state or another country. So, for instance, our federal government does not tax Oklahoma. Now, unfortunately, because we've evaded and abused constitutional limits, states have become beholden to the federal government from handouts and programs, and so we owe certain allegiance to the federal government because we take their money. If we'd quit taking their money and cut those strings, we wouldn't be beholden to the federal government because, see, they can dangle that carrot in front of us and say, now, if you don't do what we said, we're going to take back our funding. Well, first of all, it never was their funding. Remember, Paul has said this many, many times, the government has no money. All the government's money is ours. It's not theirs. But unfortunately, states have bought into programs from the federal government, and so there are strings attached. This is why states should unencumber themselves. For instance, education dollars is a prime example. Most states get about 10 or 12% of their education dollars from federal programs. In many states, studies have been done, especially in states like South Carolina. I talked with some leaders from that state not long ago, and they did a study where if they stopped taking federal dollars for education and just operated on their state money, they would actually have more money for education because they wouldn't have to meet all the federal mandates that are not funded. But you see, because they take about 10 or 12% from the federal government puts all these other mandates on them that they don't fund, and therefore the state has to use some of their state money to meet the federal mandates. Okay, but that's not taxation. Understand that a sovereign entity such as the federal government has no authority to tax a state or, for that matter, to tax Great Britain. See, that's a sovereign entity. Well, the framers believed that the church was a sovereign entity. In fact, in 1819, a particular case called McCulloch versus Maryland dealt with this very issue in determining whether or not states could tax the federal government. So it wasn't the federal government trying to tax the states, it was the other way around. Now, the reason for this is because the states were trying to get rid of the national bank. They didn't want the national bank for good reasons. I wish we didn't have it today. They knew that if the feds controlled the money, they could ultimately control us, which is where we just about are. And if they're able to ever do the federal digital dollar, which is programmable, our gooses are proverbially cooked. Because they'll be able to program that federal dollar to not work where they don't want it to work, to not buy what they don't want it to buy. I mean, we're in real trouble if that ever happens. That's why, by the way, this transactional currency down in Texas is so important, because states under the Constitution actually have the authority to coin money if it's gold and silver backed. And so if states would do that, they could bypass the federal government, for instance, the Federal Reserve note, which is not even backed by anything. It's just a promise. It's a promissory note. It's all it is. We could bypass that and have gold and silver-backed currency that would work in all states, because it would work like your debit card from your bank. You'd just put money in a depository, Texas, or if Oklahoma created one, and you'd have a card issued just like you would have a card issued from your local bank. And when you use that card, the money comes directly out of your checking account. Well, this card would be like a Visa card, and when you use it, wherever you are, the money would come immediately out of your gold that you have in your account in the depository. Okay, so that would be a way around this doggone federal digital dollar that's going to kill us all if they're able to get it going. So the founders considered the church a sovereign entity. They believed it to be outside the reach of governmental authority and taxation. Now, let me give you some examples. Early on, the colonies that are going to become states recognize this. So Virginia exempted churches from property taxes in 1777. New York did so in 1799, which is, of course, now we're after the War of Independence there. Washington, D.C. followed suit in 1802. The 7th Congress exempted all churches in America from property taxes in 1802. Why did they do that? Well, because they did not believe that the states or the federal government had the authority to tax religion. Now, we'll go further in a moment, but just understand this concept of sovereign entity, because this is part of the groundwork of why we do not, as a church, owe taxes to the state of Oklahoma or to the federal government. Even today, parsonages, which we don't have much anymore, are still exempt from property taxes in all 50 states. Now, most churches have gone to a housing allowance rather than a parsonage, which the federal government considers the same thing. The minister's housing exemption, a principle first recognized in America in 1921, was modified in Section 107(2) of the IRS Code, August 11, 1953, by Representative Peter Mack, allowing ministers of the gospel to designate a portion of compensation as a housing allowance and to exclude that amount from income to the extent that it is actually used to provide a home. Now, why is that? Well, because they believed a pastor was serving the culture and was a part of the church, and therefore the government had no right to tax it. Does that make sense to you? So here's a photograph of Representative Mack. He's from Illinois, and can you believe it? He was a Democrat, and yet he stood up for the parsonage or the housing allowance. He said, "Certainly in these times when we are being threatened by a godless and anti-religious world movement." Whoa! When was he saying that? 1953. So understand, we're not the first people to believe that we're facing a godless world power here. He said we should correct this discrimination against certain ministers of the gospel who are carrying on such a courageous fight against this foe. Certainly this is not too much to do for these people who are caring for our spiritual welfare. So this shows you the extent to which the federal government does not believe it has the right to tax the church. And in 2000, the pastor's housing allowance was challenged, and once again, the court held, and this was actually a case involving Rick Warren, a pastor in Southern California. And the court upheld in principle that parsonages or housing allowances should be considered tax exempt. And then 2 years later, President George Bush signed the Clergy Housing Allowance Clarification Act of 2002, which basically capped how much a pastor can claim but still set aside the housing allowance or the parsonage if the church still offers a parsonage as non-taxed. Now, that doesn't mean that pastors don't pay taxes. We do. But we can carve out a portion of our salary as a housing allowance, and that is not taxed. Well, where does that come from? It comes from that concept early on in our country that the government does not have the right to tax a sovereign entity like the church. It's very important. Now, there's more to it than that, but you need to get that concept. Okay, number four on the outline. The framers believed the power to tax also gave the government the power to control and to destroy. So you have to add all these together. They first believed that a sovereign entity could not tax another sovereign entity. But they also believed that if you could tax something, you could control it, and if you so desired, you could destroy it. Well, that's the one thing they did not want to do to religion. Now, we'll talk about why in just a moment. I want you to listen to what Daniel Webster said in that 1819 case of McCulloch versus Maryland, which was about the National Bank. He says, an unlimited power to tax involves necessarily a power to destroy. Now, if you think about it, you know that's true. For instance, the private ownership gun haters are trying to eliminate guns by doing what? Well, they're wanting to tax them. Now, they haven't quite done it yet, but they're wanting to tax them. And once they're able to tax your guns every year, they could tax you out of ownership because you just couldn't afford to have them. So see, the power to tax gives the government the power to control something they don't like. And if they really don't like it, they can put the taxes so high they can get rid of it. Well, see, our framers understood this. Daniel Webster is not considered officially one of our framers, but he's a part of that generation. And he understood this. In the actual case of McCulloch versus Maryland, the Supreme Court's decision was written by Chief Justice John Marshall, and he said that the power of taxing it, now what the it is the First Bank of the United States, by the states may be exercised so as to destroy it, is too obvious to be denied. The power to tax involves the power to destroy. Now, this has nothing to do with the church, but the concept does. So understand, the states didn't want a federal government having a bank, so they were going to tax it out of existence. The states were. And so this came up into the court, and they said, look, the state is a sovereign entity, but so is the federal government, and the states don't have the authority to tax another sovereign entity. You see that? That's the concept. So they understood that this power to tax can be used in a very negative way if a government wants to. So as recently as 1971, the U.S. Supreme Court has reaffirmed what they affirmed in that case in 1819. For instance, here's Chief Justice Warren Burger talking about this very subject, and he said, in a previous case that was in 1970, dealing with the same kind of thing, it was argued that a tax exemption for places of religious worship would prove to be the first step in an inevitable progression leading to the establishment of state churches and state religion. That claim could not stand up against more than 200 years of virtually universal practice embedded in our colonial experience and continuing into the present. Now, what he's saying in common language is people who are saying, well, if you don't tax the church, you're establishing religion. Therefore, you're violating the First Amendment. He said, that's nonsense. You can go all the way back to our history in the colonies and know that we've never taxed the church and we've never established a church. So that's just nonsense. So here is the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1971 recognizing that the power to tax is the power to control or to destroy, and that a sovereign entity has no authority to tax another sovereign entity. You put those two together, and he says, we've never done this in America, and we're not going to do it in America. At least he's speaking for his time. Now, if you think about it, wouldn't it have been insane for the framing generation, I'm talking about the people alive in 1776, to go fight an eight-year war just so they could win and establish a government where the government could tax the church and put it out of business? Does that make any sense at all? In fact, one of the primary reasons the colonists were fighting is they didn't want to be under the thumb of the king and his church, the Church of England. So the pastors said, if we don't stand up and fight, we're going to be forced to become Anglican, and we'll have to be a part of the king's church. Remember that the King of England was not just in charge of the country, he was in charge of the church. And he could force you to be a member of the church. He could force you to give money to the church. Well, that was one of the last things that Americans wanted. Now, what sense would it have made for them to go fight a war and then turn around and create a government that could force them to do what they just fought a war so they wouldn't have to do? Well, it's nonsense. They wouldn't have done that. Well, that helps us to understand then what the original framing generation was fighting for. They were fighting for independence from an overreaching, overbearing government. And that would include our own government. Number five, the framers. And by the way, when I say framers, understand the group I'm talking about are the James Madisons, George Washingtons, John Adamses. See, to me, the founders were the separatists that we call pilgrims and the people who came after them the first century leading up to the framing generation, which I see as the Madisons and the Washingtons and that group. Now, if you want to call them all founders, that's fine, because that's what most people do. But I kind of separate the two in my mind. So when I say framers, I'm talking about the people who framed the Republic, writing the primary two documents, the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Okay? They also helped, by the way, to frame most of the colonial, which became state governments. So these were the framers. The framers believed the church was essential for a people to be self-governing. That's another reason why the church is not taxed in America. Now, I taught this a few weeks ago, so I'm going to zip through this part and not go into great detail, except I have to restate, for those of you who weren't here, that the framers believed that if you didn't have a moral society, they could not govern themselves. Because the truth is, if you can't govern yourself, how could you govern yourself? Does that make sense? If you're immoral and you can't even restrain your own actions, how in the world could you have self-government? So this is what John Adams was trying to say to Pastor Zabdiel Adams. By the way, Zabdiel Adams was a preacher. John Adams wrote this to him on June the 21st, 1776. It is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue. And if this cannot be inspired into our people in a greater measure than they have it now, he goes on to say, we're in real trouble. So notice he's saying we have to have a virtuous people to have a republic. You remember I taught a lesson a few weeks ago how a weak church destroys a republic. Well, that's what these guys were trying to say here. They said, look, we have to have a moral people. This is what George Washington was trying to say when he said, look, if we're going to have a free government, then we have to have religion and morality. Now, when they said religion, they meant Christianity. They said, if the church is not effective in making an impact on our culture to make them more moral, then we're in real trouble. This is why John Adams said, we can't create a government that can restrain immoral people, because they'll just run through the Constitution like a whale would run through a net. And then he goes on to say, let me back up here. He says, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. See what he's trying to say here? If you don't have a moral culture, that culture cannot govern itself. Benjamin Franklin said this in 1787, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. Now notice what has happened in America. As we've become less religious, we've become more immoral. And the more immoral we've become, what have we done to our government? We've expected more of it and we've grown it. This is exactly what Benjamin Franklin was warning against. If we're not moral, we'll need a lot of government. Now, I gave you this quote last time, but this is Robert Winthrop. He was Speaker of the House in the mid-1800s, and here's what he said. All societies of men must be governed in some way or other. The less they have of stringent state government, the more they must have of individual self-government. The less they rely on public law or physical force, the more they must rely on private moral restraint. All men, in a word, must necessarily be controlled either by a power within them or by a power without them. Either by the word of God or by the strong arm of man, either by the Bible or by the bayonet. So this is what they're all saying. We see the framers then believed that to have a republic, we had to have a strong church. Well, the last thing you want to do if you want a strong church is to tax it and control it. Because you put anything in the hands of the government, and what do they do? Make it better? Ha, ha, ha. You remember Ronald Reagan was famous for saying the scariest words you'll ever hear, "Hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help." That's the opposite of what big government does. Big government always corrupts almost everything it touches. It's just the nature of government. It wants to ensure its own survival, and so it'll chew up all of the resources and the people it's supposed to be protecting to grow itself. That's just the way it is. But you have to have some kind of moral restraint. You have to have some kind of governance, and the more immoral people become, the more government they have to have. And that's, I believe, is the reason why today our federal and state governments are so out of control. Because we've become so immoral. We know that we need more government. What we really need is more revival. If we had more revival, you know what would happen? We'd shrink our governments. But we're never going to shrink our government as long as we're growing our immorality. Now, I don't know who that quote is from. I've never heard it other than from myself. But you're never going to shrink your growing government if you have growing immorality in the culture. You're just not going to do it. Number six, during the entire history of the Internal Revenue Service, not one church, now I want you to catch that, not one church has ever lost its tax-exempt status because of political speech. This is normally one of those, oh my gosh, moments at these pastors' conferences. Because they think that there have been tons of churches that have had their doors closed by the IRS because the pastor got up there and even though he was scared to death, said something political, and the IRS called him on Monday morning and said, "We're coming in this week to shut your church down," and they did, and that's all you ever heard of that church. Well, that'd really be true if it weren't so wrong. There has never, ever been one church that's lost its tax-exempt status because of speaking out on political issues. Not two, not three, not four, not one. And boy, that is a wow moment for preachers. The closest any church ever came was a church in Binghamton, I guess is how you say that. If anybody's from New York, you can tell me how to say that. Binghamton. Thank you very, very much. New York. It was a church called Church at Pierce Creek. Here's what they did. If you remember back in the Bill Clinton days, the USA Today and other newspapers, the Washington Times in particular, were huge. And so they ran full-page ads in both of those newspapers on October the 30th, 1992, encouraging people not to vote for Bill Clinton. Now, this church ran these two full-page ads in the USA Today and the Washington Times. Not only did they run the ads, but they solicited donations in the ads. Now, most churches would never have the guts to run the ads, but they would never, if they ran the ads, also solicit donations. Well, people went, they're going to lose their tax-exempt status. Boy, they've crossed over the line. Well, they did get mighty close, I guess, but going further, as I said, they asked for donations. Here's the amazing thing. That church never lost its tax-exempt status. Not even for doing that. Took their own church funds and ran those ads. Now, should they have done that? Well, we could argue whether or not that was a smart move. But the point I'm trying to make to you is even though that church did that, they did not lose their tax-exempt status. The only thing that they lost was what is called the tax-exempt advance letter. Now, let me tell you what that means. If you form a church and you make it a 501c3, the IRS will send you a letter in advance of, quote, giving you official status as a 501c3. We'll talk in a moment about whether or not churches ought to be that. But let's forget about that right now. They'll send you an advance letter. That letter is, that's all it is. It's just a letter. And that's the worst that the IRS was able to do. They revoked that letter. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means absolutely nothing. Even though they lost that letter, the church never lost its non-tax status. In fact, it's important for us to know that you don't even have to have that letter. In fact, not only do you not have to have that letter, a church doesn't have to be a 501c3 to be tax exempt. Why in the world then are most churches 501c3s? Because most churches today are. Well, I don't know all of the reasons. A lot of it now is just, well, that's what you do. But actually, I remember a time when churches weren't 501c3s. that was weird for a church to be a 501c3. But I do remember something when I was a young man that happened. There were a few churches where people fell on a wet floor or whatever, and they sued the church for a lot of money. And so insurance companies started telling churches, boy, you need to incorporate so that you can limit your liability. Because if you don't limit your liability, someone could actually sue every member of your church. Now, whether or not that was true, I remember when pastors were terrified that all of their people were vulnerable to a lawsuit. So a lot of pastors started filing for 501c3 status to limit the liability so that the person that wanted to slip down and fall and then sue the church could only sue the corporation, and that was it. They couldn't get to the individual members. Now, that was one of the reasons, I believe, that churches early on started filing for 501c3s. You say, well, Dan, what happens if you don't file? Well, the federal government just recognizes you as tax-exempt anyway. The church that I helped to found in Yukon never became a 501c3. And I actually encourage pastors to consider not doing that. There's actually something that Congress did. They created what is called a 508C1A that bypasses the IRS. And I tell pastors, if you're going to file for something, file for that. I've even been talking with the powers lately about how that might affect my own ministry. But you just need to know that a church doesn't have to be a 501c3 to be tax exempt. In fact, the IRS recognizes a church that isn't a 501c3 as a 501c3. They treat them the same. The C, of course, stands for corporation. And I don't know that that's a smart move for a church to be a corporation. So I encourage pastors to consider either not being a 501c3 or maybe getting rid of their own 501c3 if they already are one. Now, that's a matter that the church needs to decide on its own. It's not anything that I'd be dogmatic about. But the church is already non-taxed if it's a church. Now, there is a definition of a church, and we would want it that way because you want certain qualifications to determine what a church is, because you don't want just anybody being able to claim they're a church. There have actually been individuals who said, I'm a church, and tried to file for a 501c3 to not have to pay taxes. They said, well, I'm a church. So, well, you're not either. And so a church obviously needs to have some distinguishing characteristics, but in the end, a church is not taxed. Now, here is a problem that Oklahoma does have. If you don't have a federal tax number in Oklahoma, they'll make you pay sales tax in Oklahoma, which Oklahoma ought to fix that. What Oklahoma should do is recognize all churches that meet the definition of what anybody would see a church as being, give all churches tax-exempt status where you don't have to have a doggone federal number. So a lot of churches in Oklahoma will go ahead and become a 501c3 so they can have that federal tax ID number so they don't have to pay sales tax in Oklahoma. I would say it'd be better off just to pay the sales tax in Oklahoma and not mess with the IRS. But that's my personal opinion. But that's important to understand. Now, I'm not going to belabor these quotes, but the Supreme Court even eventually chimed in on this Pierce Creek Church, and they said, look, the worst thing that they could do is take away that letter. And if you'll notice on your outline, this quote is actually on your outline. It says, to revoke that letter is likely to be more symbolic than substantial. In other words, what they're saying is it really doesn't mean anything. It's just kind of smoke and mirrors for the IRS to try to revoke that letter. And then the court went on to say there would be nothing to keep that church from reapplying the very next day for that letter to be restored. In other words, this is just a game, basically, that the IRS is playing. So I guess a church could technically speak out on something they're not supposed to. The IRS revoked their letter. The church could then on Monday morning reapply because they're done talking about it for a week and get their letter back and then do it again and then have to reapply and do it again and reapply and do it again and reapply. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's just a silly game. In fact, Matt Staver from Liberty Council, for those of you who know Matt, you know that Matt is very helpful to a lot of churches, even going as far as the U.S. Supreme Court in many cases. In fact, he's won a number of the COVID cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. He says basically a church, if it lost its tax-exempt status, could just reapply after the election and say, well, now that the election's gone, we won't be talking about the election and reapply. Or I've told pastors what they could do is dissolve that church, reconstitute it under a different name, and start all over again. How many different names could you come up with for a church? Well, quite a few. What I'm saying is churches that are running around afraid of the IRS are only giving them power that they really don't have. And if the church would stop running and start standing, you'd be amazed at what would happen to the IRS. In fact, when we stood up about the Johnson Amendment, you know what the IRS has done about that? Nothing. You say, well, Dan, they will one of these days. Well, sure, the church keeps rolling up and getting into a fetal position, and we won't stand up and we won't speak out. Eventually, yeah, we're going to empower the federal government to the point that it's going to try to shut down the church. It tried during COVID. Think back. Where was it that you couldn't go during the COVID lockdowns? You could go to Walmart. You could go to Home Depot. You could go to Lowe's. You could go get an abortion. But you couldn't go to church. Because, see, that was a church virus. So that's where you get it. So it wasn't Wuhan. It was a church virus, right? It was crazy. They tipped their hand, though, as to who they're really targeting. What they're targeting is the church. And why is that? Because they hate the gospel. They hate the gospel. When you boil everything down that the left does, it's always pointed at the gospel. When countries fall under totalitarian governments, whether they're communist or whatever, one of the first things those governments always do is shut down freedom of speech and the church. They drive the church underground. It's what it's always been. It's what it's always going to be. Number seven, let's talk about the Johnson Amendment. Because now that we know that the IRS has never shut down a church ever for political speech, well, Dan, doesn't the Johnson Amendment command that we not say anything political from the pulpit? Well, first of all, understand that the Johnson Amendment, I believe, is completely unconstitutional. But you also need to know that when Lyndon B. Johnson, whose name is in the Johnson Amendment, filed for the Johnson Amendment, most churches were not 501c3s in those days. So let's look at a little bit of the history of how the Johnson Amendment came to be. As most of you know, Lyndon B. Johnson was vice president to John F. Kennedy, became president upon Kennedy's assassination. But before that, he was a senator in Texas. In fact, his first election was in 1948. Johnson's senatorial victory was so razor thin with a margin of only 87 votes. Now, you're talking about a close vote. 87 votes. That his challenger, Coke Stevenson, was able to present some pretty credible evidence that Johnson had probably stolen the election through fraud. Well, you know that they'd never have fraud in elections, right? But with some creative judicial wrangling, Johnson was able to use court injunctions to retain probably his stolen victory. So here's the point. When he was first elected to the Senate, he got in there by the skin of his teeth, probably illegally, okay? So he's barely a senator from Texas. Well, when he runs for re-election in 1954, he knows he has an uphill battle. Well, here's the problem. There was a conservative businessman in Texas by the name of Hunt who didn't want Lyndon B. Johnson to be reelected as a senator from Texas. So he created a couple of conservative groups. One was called Facts and Forum. You'll see it right there about the middle of that quote. And the Committee for Constitutional Government. Well, what they were doing was pointing out Johnson's flaws. And one of them is that he was soft on communism. Well, Johnson knew that he had barely won his first election. If he even had a chance at being reelected, he was going to have to silence these conservative voices. So as senator, what he did is on July the 2nd, 1954, with the assistance of a complicit, I would even say ignorant, Senate, Johnson was able to insert into the tax code, it's not really statutory law, it's tax law. He was able to insert into tax law what has been known ever since as the Johnson Amendment. Now, basically what the Johnson Amendment originally said, and then they've augmented it over the years, but originally what it said is that 501c3 nonprofit organizations, remember the two he was after, FACTS and FORUM, and the Committee on Constitutional Government, those two groups formed by Mr. Hunt, he wanted to shut them up. Well, in those days, as I said, most churches were not 501c3s. In fact, people who knew Lyndon B. Johnson said it was never his even thought to go after the church. What has been done is over the years, they have expanded the definition of the Johnson Amendment and the 501c3s. And in the process, most churches have become 501c3s. And we've now fallen under the Johnson Amendment. So they've augmented the language to also include churches. And so churches aren't supposed to be able to speak in favor of or against a political candidate. And that's the Johnson Amendment. Now, the history of the Johnson Amendment is incredibly short. That's all there is. That's all there is in the congressional record. Those are actual quotes taken right out of the congressional record from 1954. That's it. That's all there is on the Johnson Amendment. Basically, what happened is Lyndon B. Johnson submitted the change that we call the Johnson Amendment. The Senate, not even knowing probably what it was, approved it, and that was it. And Johnson was able to shut up those two groups in Texas and was able to secure his second senatorial victory. But the Johnson Amendment has become something that is used to silence churches because most churches have become 501c3s. Here's the amazing thing. The Johnson Amendment doesn't even mention pastors. The last time I checked, the pastor is not a church. Right? Now, a lot of people say, well, but the pastor speaks officially for the church. I have found that that's not normally the case. In fact, I can get up here and preach my guts out on Sunday morning, and a lot of you will go out on Monday and prove that you don't have to do a dadgum thing that I said the day before on Sunday from this pulpit. I obviously do not speak for a lot of folks. You see, a pastor does not surrender his First Amendment rights, which are really not First Amendment rights. They're just enumerated in the First Amendment. Our rights come from God, not the First Amendment. But a pastor does not surrender his right to free speech just because he stands behind a pulpit. And so I've been trying to tell pastors for years, and that was a part of that Pulpit Freedom Initiative where we actually disobeyed the Johnson Amendment, that pastors are not bound by the Johnson Amendment. Does he mention pastors? Now, should churches officially endorse candidates? I think probably not. But this church doesn't. We've had a reporter tailing Paul and myself for weeks since we allowed Brian Shellum to speak here, who was the conservative candidate for mayor of Edmond. And he's trying to interview us because he says that we violated the Johnson Amendment and all this stuff by allowing him to speak. Do you ever remember us having a vote that morning after he spoke to officially endorse him as Liberty Church of Edmond? No, I remember Paul endorsing him. And the only reason I didn't endorse him, I was behind him, but I'm not a citizen of Edmond, so my endorsement really wouldn't mean that much. But Paul endorsed him, but I believe Paul has every right to endorse him. Paul's an individual who has rights under God. He can endorse whoever he wants to. So see, I believe the Johnson Amendment, like the IRS scare, they're going to take away your tax-exempt status when they've never, ever done it to any church in the history of the IRS. I think the Johnson Amendment is used the same way to intimidate pastors who don't know any better and who probably don't have much of a spine to begin with to just shy away from anything that looks controversial. They've all got a big yellow streak running down their backs. In fact, I've often said that most of the red brick churches and the churches painted white in America should all be painted yellow because it would better reflect their leadership. Because most pastors are cowards. And so if they even think that they're in trouble of breaking some kind of taboo, and of course they're all terrified about controversy in their pulpits anyway, so they're just terrified about doing anything that would cause, you know, Deacon Drysdust or Sister Battleaxe to get all upset, and they don't want that to happen, so they're not going to do anything to make waves. Interestingly, though, in 2016, the Pew Research Center did a study. And oddly enough, they found that black Protestants have been more likely than other Christian groups to report having heard their clergy, pastors, speak out clearly on the merits or faults of a particular candidate. In fact, there's video of black churches taking offerings to be given to Barack Obama as he was running for president. They don't care. They don't worry about it. In fact, here's what this study discovered. 28% of black Protestants heard their clergy speak in support of Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign. 28%. That's a pretty big number. 20% of black Protestants said that they had heard their ministers denounce Donald Trump. Clearly a left and right position. Only 4% of white evangelicals reported having heard their clergy speak in favor of a presidential candidate, which is a crime, just to be honest with you. 2% heard them speak about and for Trump, while 7% heard their clergy speak against a candidate, mostly against Clinton. So notice this, 28% of black churches speak out, 4% of white churches. So the greater violators are American black churches. When was the last time you heard a news story where the IRS was going to go shut down a black church? Never. So here's what I'm saying. We're afraid of nothing. It's like we're afraid of our own shadow. See, I believe the federal government knows that they can't do anything, really. But we keep giving ground to them, and eventually they will. When we did the Pulpit Freedom Initiative, the very first year, there were only 33 of us that were vetted and then trained by the ADF organization to know how to handle the whole deal, because we thought the IRS would come after us. Because if you remember, we sent our sermons into the IRS on Monday morning. Many of us sent recordings and said, this is what I preached in my pulpit yesterday, and we all endorsed John McCain. And we did it right from our pulpits because we wanted them to come after us. Well, they did absolutely nothing. So the next general election, we had 100 pastors that officially participated. We did the same thing, sent the stuff into the IRS. You know what the IRS did? Nothing. So the next general election that came along, 500 pastors officially participated. IRS, nothing. The last official Pulpit Freedom Sunday that we had, over 1,600 pastors officially participated. And many other hundreds of them participated unofficially because their churches wouldn't support them. But they did it anyway. They just weren't officially aligned with ADF. We were told, I've never seen a copy of it, but we were told that an unofficial memo was unofficially leaked from the IRS that admitted they don't have the authority to tell pastors what they can and can't preach about. And ever since 2008, that was the very first Pulpit Freedom Sunday, the IRS has done absolutely nothing. Why? Because they know they can't. So here we are giving in to a group of people who really do not have the power. So since the church has been tax exempt since our founding, therefore does not need to have a 501c3 status to be tax exempt, since the Johnson Amendment ultimately violates the First Amendment by limiting freedom of speech and religion, in the end, pastors and churches should and must preach the truth on every subject, regardless of the cost. Preserving our tax-exempt status should not be our number one goal. Preserving truth and liberty should be. So even if it was against the law, well, do it anyway. Because liberty and truth are more important than paying taxes. So the church should not be nearly as afraid of losing its tax-exempt status as it is in hedging on the truth and on liberty. And so this is what we tell pastors. We tell pastors, guys, first of all, you're afraid of your own shadow. And secondly, you need to be bold as lions. God has called us to take the fight to the enemy, not run and hide somewhere. You know, when Jesus said the gates of hell will not prevail against the church was in the active, not passive voice. Now, a lot of people say, we mean active voice. Well, in the Greek language, you have active and passive. Most of us see the church as holding out to the end as hell just pushes against us. The gates of hell push against the church, and we're just holding on. You remember the old song we used to sing? Hold the fort, for I am coming. So we're just holding on because we're in the passive voice. But Jesus actually said that in the active voice. Do you know how Jesus said it? The gates of hell cannot prevail against our assault. We're in the active stance, not passive. But most churches today are passive. not active. So here's what I will do for the next 7 minutes, and then we'll do our prayer time and we'll be out of here on time. I want you to listen to what Matt Staver says, because for a lot of pastors, he carries a lot of legal clout because he's the founder and the president of Liberty Counsel and fights this issue. Matt is a little more guarded in some ways than I am, but he probably has to be. But I want you to listen. It's about a 7-minute video, and then we'll be done and hear what Matt has to say about everything that I've been talking about. And amazingly, you're going to hear him confirm everything I've been saying.
Hi, I'm Matt Staver, founder and chairman of Liberty Counsel. Liberty Counsel is a national religious liberty organization advancing the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, and God's design for family. We have offices in Orlando, Florida, Washington, D.C., and in Virginia. We have hundreds of affiliate attorneys all across this country. We are very active in front of the United States Supreme Court and recently won a 9-0 decision involving Christian viewpoint censorship in the case of Shurtleff versus City of Boston. It's very difficult to get a unanimous decision from the High Court, and by God's grace, we did. And that case has had an amazing effect around the country with regards to not only religious freedom, but also free speech, particularly from Christian viewpoints, and even overturning the Establishment Clause gloss that the Supreme Court invented in 1971 that frankly perverted portions of the First Amendment. As a pastor and as an attorney, this topic is very important to me, pastors, churches, and political activity, especially at this time in American and world history. We're literally standing at an incredible point in history. On June 24, 2022, the United States Supreme Court overturned these terrible abortion decisions going all the way back to 1973. But whether we're going to be a country that supports and advances the sanctity of human life really depends upon our actions now. Actions that are taking place in Congress and in the various states. And really, it depends upon you as pastors and leaders in your churches and your communities to be the voice that God designs and calls you to be to our community. History is going to be written, and the question is, did we take advantage of this opportunity to secure the sanctity of human life and protect innocent children in the womb, or did we miss this opportunity? Will we continue, as usual, slaughtering millions and millions of innocent, helpless babies? Will we be the generation that restores religious freedom, or will it be lost on our watch? Is this a time for revival? God is calling you as pastors and his followers to speak up at such a critical time. With regards to pastors, churches, and political activity, I want to talk about what you can do, and clearly you have a lot of freedom. I also want to talk about one of the big issues facing us, and that is the COVID pandemic, including these so-called vaccine passports and their threat to our freedom, including religious freedom. There are two categories in the IRS with regards to political activity regarding nonprofit organizations. One is the lobbying section that was entered into the IRS code in 1934, and the other is the political intervention in 1954. The point, however, is no church has ever lost its tax-exempt status under either of these restrictions in the IRS code. The definition of lobbying is supporting or opposing local, state, or national laws. It includes voter initiatives and political nominations or appointments, whether it by the president of the United States or whether it be by the local governor of your state. You may not, under this lobbying provision, devote more than what the IRS code says, a substantial part of the organization's overall activity to lobbying. The general guidelines for nonprofit organizations, which include churches, would be 5% is okay, 15% would be crossing the line. But let's apply this 5% minimum. We're talking about a do-nothing church. This do-nothing church has only 3 hours on Sunday, 9 to 12, an hour and a half midweek, 7, for example, to 8:30 in the evening. A total operation of only 4.5 hours. That particular church that operates 4.5 hours can dedicate 13.5 minutes each week toward lobbying. This particular church has no paid staff, and there's no preparation before or even thought after these 4.5 hours by either the pastor or the members of the church. No paid staff, nothing. It only has an existence of 4.5 hours a week, Every week you could devote 13 and a half minutes each time in your sermon, if you chose to do so every Sunday for 52 Sundays, toward lobbying for or against local, state, or national legislation. But let's skip a week. That 13 and a half minutes then is times two, or 13 and a half minutes if you skip 2 weeks and you don't talk about lobbying is 13 and a half minutes times three. It doesn't look at what you do on that particular day, but what you do throughout a period of a year. The continued application of this 5% minimum, now let's look at a pastor who's paid 40 hours and an assistant who works 20 hours. There's five members that volunteer 1 hour each week. That means this particular church has 69 and a half hours total. That church could devote 3.5 hours every week toward lobbying with regards to legislation. And that includes placing the church's name in favor of or in opposition to a constitutional amendment, a nomination for a Supreme Court justice, an appointment by the governor, or a particular local, state, or federal law. That's why no church has ever lost its tax-exempt status. You would have to turn your church into a political machine and literally operate like that all the time, because you look at all the activity, paid and unpaid, over a time period of a year, for example. Let's look at the 1954 political intervention provision. That was entered into the IRS code without any debate by then Senator Lyndon Johnson, later President Johnson, because a nonprofit organization, not a church, opposed his candidacy. And he wanted to get back at that nonprofit organization. So the IRS code said that nonprofit organizations, which would include churches, whether or not you have a tax-exempt letter or do not have a tax-exempt letter, and churches do not need tax-exempt letters, by the way, to receive tax exemption, other nonprofit organizations, not churches, do need tax-exempt letters from the IRS to receive tax exemption. With or without this particular letter, this still applies to churches. The definition is you may not support or oppose a candidate for elected office. That's an absolute prohibition. Now, nominees or appointments such as Supreme Court nominees or other nominees or appointed positions, they fall under the lobbying, not political intervention section. Clearly, what's permissible activity is that you can preach on any topic. You can educate. You can explain the positions of the candidates. You can have objective voter guides that you put on a screen or hand out. You can have candidates speak with regards to various issues from the pulpit. You can acknowledge a candidate that's running for office. You may actually have candidate forums where you invite the candidates to talk about their particular positions. And frankly, you can invite all the candidates, the more the better. And in fact, when you hear the candidates that don't coincide with your biblical worldview, it becomes very obvious. And obviously, you can preach before and after that particular candidate forum on biblical worldview and how you would apply it to those situations. You can also have voter registration and so much more. Pastors also are citizens, and you can lend your name, title, and affiliation against or for a candidate. All you have to have is title and affiliation for identification purposes, and that's it. What you can do is not have fear. No church has ever lost its tax exemption for lobbying or political intervention, so I encourage you to replace the muzzle with a megaphone. Let's talk now about one of the big issues facing.
So if you notice there, he's saying that the church cannot officially endorse, but pastors can't. But churches can lobby. Did you see that the do-nothing church could lobby a great deal of its time? And if you have just a few paid staff members, you could lobby 3.5, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, depending on how much activity in church. Every lobby. You could officially lobby. This is why when this reporter has been following us around saying, well, we heard that you had, you know, candidate Shalom to speak in your church, you realize you violated. We didn't violate anything. And therefore, Paul and I have really not granted him an interview because they're not going to be fair. One of the things I learned about the media when I was in the legislature, they act like they care about what you're saying. They couldn't care less about what you're saying. They'll interview you for 15 minutes, play 15 seconds, and use the dumbest thing you say and take it and spin it out of context and make you look ignorant. I mean, that's just what they're doing. And so I normally advise pastors, don't grant interviews. And if you're going to grant one that's live, where it's released live. Now, here's the problem. It's only live maybe at the 6 o'clock news, but after that, they can edit it for the 10 o'clock. So you have to be very, very careful. But the bottom line is this. Guys, the church has so much latitude without even coming close to getting into trouble with the IRS that it's a shame that most churches sit around and won't do anything because they're so convinced that it's against the law. It is not against the law. And I think we're going to have to account to God for being such cowards, just to be quite honest with you. So you can see that Matt's speech was directed to pastors. So you can imagine what kind of impact that has on these pastors as they're sitting there listening to the founder and the president of Liberty Council. They could just as easily listen to Don or G.K. Powers and hear the same thing. But just the fact that they know who Matt Staver is and all that, I mean, they're sitting there going, good grief. And here's the other thing. Liberty Council promises to defend them if they do get crossways with the IRS or the federal government. They'll come in and defend them. Now, those guys, can you imagine how empowered these preachers feel as they walk out of there? That's the whole purpose. And this is why I stand in front of them, and that's why it's so helpful then when Matt comes along right after me and actually agrees with everything that I've just told them so that they know it's not just one crazy preacher. I am a crazy preacher, but it's not just one crazy preacher. There's a bunch of crazy preachers that are teaching this stuff. Well, so that gives you an idea then of what we teach pastors on the IRS, the Johnson Amendment, and it may help to clear up some ambiguity in your own mind where you've wondered, man, did Dan and Paul, did Paul step over the line the other Sunday when he had O'Brien to speak here and then when Paul got up and endorsed him? No, Paul has every right to endorse and so do I, and we had every right to have right. And by the way, you don't have to have the other candidate. You can if you choose to, but we're not a radio show. You don't have to give equal time. So just understand, guys, we are more than safe here. Now, you'll hear people say that we're breaking the law. Well, then why don't they come arrest us? It's because we're not breaking the law. So anyway, that's what we teach pastors on the IRS, the church, and the Johnson Amendment. And hopefully that is helpful to you, if for no other reason, to know what we're telling these pastors. And then we send them out of there and tell them, now get busy. Grow a backbone and start speaking on these things and quit hedging and quit running.